Okay, so it's our pleasure to have Oliver teach us about elliptic multiple zeta values and superstring one-loop amplitudes. And here is your...
Okay, thanks a lot for the introduction. And most of all, I'm very grateful to the organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak. I'll present some work done in collaboration with Johannes Brödel in the audience, with Carlos Mafran, who, by the way, resolved the factor of three issue in his three-loop calculation, and with Niels Mattes, who is a mathematician in Hamburg. It's about elliptic multiple zeta values and superstring one-loop amplitudes. As you can anticipate from the title, this talk is meant to build a bridge between number theory, pure math, and physics, in particular amplitudeology. And the field of applications for these interesting periods is the scattering of open superstring states. More precisely, I'm going to the massless vector of the superstring spectrum where you find the gauge boson and its supersymmetry multiplets. So it's all about gluon scattering in presence of an infinity of extra vibration modes from the string. And it turns out that these string calculations, these scattering amplitudes in string theory, are a very natural setup to meet iterated integrals in a quite pure context. So whenever you scatter string states, you have to discuss the world sheet that describes that string scattering. The world sheet is the surface and space-time that you get if you keep track of the trajectories of the string, of all the different strings that you might wish to scatter. And for open strings, these world sheets have boundaries, such that the open string states can dock on that boundary. And the perturbative expansion is done in a topological way in string theory. Hence, a tree-level amplitude corresponds to a world sheet of disk topology. And notice that there's a notion of ordering to the boundary of the disk. So you always know which stringy state is neighbor of which other state. That's why you get iterated integrals where you impose strict ordering on the integration variables. So a cartoon of the typical integrals inside such a tree amplitude is this one. Iterated integral over plenty of differential forms classifiable as D log Z, which you also saw plenty of times in Eric Panzer's talk. And before you can get to this pure form of the integral, you have to deal with the vertex operators of the open string states. In other words, you have to peel off the polarization dependence, polarization vectors or fermion wave functions. And all of this has been done quite systematically at tree level for any number of external states. You can always peel off super Young-Mills trees, as shown in 2011. And then you're left with scalar integrals, whose alpha prime expansion gives you at each order such multiple zeta values. Alpha prime being the inverse string tension, so alpha prime expansion is something like an expansion around the point particle limit. There are many things to say about how the multiple zeta values appear here, but I won't have time to cover this. You find motivic multiple zeta values in use, you find Rinfeld associators. Yeah, that was done in the past. So in this talk, I want to report on progress at genus 1. If you compute a one-loop scattering amplitude among open string states, a world sheet topology of interest is the cylinder. So here I'm restricting the attention to the planar version of the cylinder, where all the states are attached at one boundary, but in principle there could also be insertions down here, which would correspond to multi-trace operators with respect to the color gauge group. And in practical terms, an open string world sheet can be described using the doubling trick from the closed string counterpart. So the disk is, roughly speaking, half a sphere, and accordingly, the cylinder is half a torus. So in many places of the talk, I might discuss a torus, but secretly knowing that you can return to the cylinder at any time. So we'll talk a lot about suitable functions on a torus, which you can describe using a modular parameter, as you have seen it in Christian's talk. And if you now alpha prime expand these superstring one-loop amplitudes after peeling off kinematics, you are left behind with, again, iterated integrals. They're iterated because of the clear notion of neighboring. And in the same way as the tree-level iterated integrals gave multiple zeta values, it turns out that each order in alpha prime at one loop gives rise to an elliptic analog of multiple zeta values, elliptic multiple zeta values. They have been studied by mathematicians already before the connection with superstring amplitudeology was established. And yeah, it was a great case of luck for us that we ran into Niels, who's one of the experts from the mathematics camp on these objects. So I will soon define what kind of suitable objects you should integrate these objects called Fn that furnish the elliptic analog of the D-log Zs from genus 0. The plan for my talk is I'll first of all set the stage and define these functions Fn for you, and of course the elliptic multiple zeta value will be defined using analogies with genus 0 whenever possible. Then part 2 is the physics side. There I will go in more detail to the superstring one loop amplitudes and give you some examples how leading alpha prime orders land you on very non-trivial cases of elliptic multiple zeta values. And then in part 3 I'll return to mass. I'll discuss what kind of relations exist between elliptic multiple zeta values. As you know very well, there are very interesting stories at genus 0 to study the shuffle and stuffle relations among multiple zeta values. And I'll discuss methods to determine the indecomposable EMZVs in the same way as for the multiple zeta values. There is a belief that certain instances can't be boiled down to simpler objects. All right, the correspondence between the papers and the parts of the talk should be clear from here. Let's start with a definition of Fn and of elliptic multiple zeta values. And many of the things are closely following the lines of the genus zero reasoning. So let me recall you of some objects which you have seen in Eric Panzer's talk. He has defined multiple polylogarithms, which are obtained by the star here, that differential form d log t. And if you perform an iterated integral over these d log t's, then you can build up larger and larger functions, capital G, where these labels here, the a's, keep track of the differential forms you have used, and where the argument z keeps track of the upper integration limit. And you can specialize these multiple polylogarithms, send the upper limit to z equal 1, and then you land on the integral representation of multiple zeta values, which you can describe using a two-letter alphabet. Two letters meaning the differential forms here can be specialized to A equals 0 or A equals 1. Multiple zeta values are all about words and zeros and ones. And there's a notion of weight for both the polylogarithm and the multiple zeta value. The transcendental weight is defined to be the number of integrations. And it turns out that this weight is preserved under all known Q relations of these guys. One less appreciated fact about this function system is there are a lot of identities to shuffle around the labels and the arguments. And Eric Panzer mentioned this in the context of the differential equations satisfied by polylogarithms. And one very interesting application of that is you might not like to see the argument once more in front of the semicolon. So there are manipulations based on the differential equation to change the alphabet or to make sure that your argument does not occur once more before the semicolon. This might sound technical, but has a very interesting impact on the elliptic generalization. And all of these differential manipulations are based on partial fraction identities, just very trivial algebraic statements that I hardly dare to put on the slide here. And I will ask the question how to obtain an analog of partial fraction on the elliptic curve for functions on the torus. Okay, so let me show you the same slide once more, where everything is now generalized to elliptic world. Once more, we start with an alphabet of differential forms, which we can integrate again and again. And for each step of integration, you add one more letter to the overall elliptic iterated integral. But this time, you need two sort of house numbers for the differential forms you meet. There's first of all here this shift of the argument, pretty analogous to previously. But also, now I have a larger alphabet of sensible differential forms, Fn. So here, this superscript here is an integer, which is not only 0 and 1, like at genus 0, but this time we need an infinite alphabet, so Ni can take any integer value, non-negative. And accordingly, you keep track of all this in labeling your elliptic iterated integral. Okay, we ultimately want to get to an analog of multiple zeta values, so this elliptic iterated integral will be specialized such that the upper limit is unity. So as a specialization of this, we define elliptic multiple zeta values as a collection of these Fn's, which I'll define shortly for you. And yeah, you have to keep track of which F's you use, so accordingly, these elliptic multiple zeta values are labeled by a string of non-negative integers. And here I'm cheating a little bit. I have prepared some formulas which you might need again and again in this talk. So for later reference, this definition of an elliptic multiple zeta value is displayed here. And in the same way as we had a notion of weight at genus zero, a conserved quantity under Q relations, we define a weight for elliptic multiple zeta values. And it's not the number of integrations, but instead the weight is the sum of these superscripts, these house numbers n. So this is now the conserved quantity, the sum of all these n's. Whereas the number of integrations, well, it's called the length, turns out to be violated by some relations that I'll display later on. And there's an analogy to the differential equations from the previous slide. You can manipulate these elliptic iterated integrals in a way that you can remove certain variables from the labels. And this is once more based on some relations at the integrand level that generalize partial fraction. I mean, in partial fraction, you have the situation where two copies of d log z appears, and you can trade it for just a single copy. And we would like to insist that our fm's have the same property, that they can avoid a double appearance of an fn of z minus something. And this is, say, the highest priority item on the wish list to arrive at sensible functions f. And that's also the reason why the alphabet is infinite here. Okay, so these are the analogies between the elliptic world to be shown and some genus zero stories which you have heard in Eric Panzer's talk in a nice fashion. Now, to be more concrete about the precise form of the fn's, let me recall you of a torus parametrization, which you have seen in Christian's talk. Like him, I parametrize a torus using a complex coordinate, and the fact that there are two homology cycles on the torus translates into a double periodicity. Any function on the torus should better be periodic, say in the red direction, which means z going to z plus 1, but also in the blue direction, for which I need an additional complex number, tau, the modular parameter. So all the functions should be doubly periodic, and here, since this number tau characterizes my torus, all the elliptic multiple zeta values will be functions of tau. They are no longer just real numbers, but they are functions of tau, have more structure in that sense. And in order to construct sensible iterated integrals in this framework, I should better use integrands that do respect the double periodicity, both in the red direction and in the blue direction. So how can we implement double periodicity? So this calls for a special class of functions, so-called Jacobi theta functions. And here I'm giving you a toy example of that. They have an infinite product representation. Well, I don't want to bother you with all the details of this formula, but just believe me, this is the closest you can get to the identity. I want to have a function that, in the neighborhood of the origin, behaves like z, and all the rest, except for the z, is just a tail to ensure the double periodicity. So please don't worry if you are uncomfortable with some parts of the infinite product. And since we looked at differential forms at tree level that went like 1 over z, we should implement 1 over z on the torus. What's the closest you can get to 1 over z on an elliptic curve? And this is the logarithmic derivative of this theta function here. So this is something like 1 over z plus a tail to ensure the double periodicity. And amusingly, that tail even includes a non-holomorphic piece. It turns out that we can't help sacrificing holomorphicity to ensure these good double periodic properties on the torus. So here, that guy here is the elliptic analog of 1 over z, and this is the first instance, F1, of the infinite letter alphabet of differential forms to appear in EMZVs. Two more remarks about that thing. The holomorphicity I already mentioned, but certainly F1 is also periodic under z going to z plus 1, as you can see trivially from the sign and the Fourier expansion. So F1 is not only the 1 over z generalization, but also it covers the second letter from genus 0, the d log 1 minus z. So F1 is a bit like a hybrid, implementing both differential forms from genus 0 at the same time. How do we get variety? How do we produce more differential forms? And this is the content of the next slide. We want to adjoin the infinitely other friends, like F2, F3, dot, 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 all the way up to infinity. And the smoking gun to sense their presence is, try to repeat the partial fraction exercise. as an important consistency condition for the iterated integrals, I should be able to manipulate away a double appearance of Z. That's something very trivial at genus 0, but slightly less trivial for the F1, which we have just constructed. So if I try to mimic the partial fraction trick using the F1, I'll fail, but I will fail up to a double periodic function, F2. So the failure of partial fraction signals that I need an F2, and if I repeat that thing with F2 here, I generate F3, so we can go iteratively all the way up and see that we need infinitely many letters. And by the way, I also adjoin the trivial letter F0 just being 1. Okay, a warning for the subsequent. I'm too lazy to carry around tau all the time. Please remember, everything you see in the subsequent is a function of tau. I simply won't display it anymore. Good. What's the explicit form of this F2 and all higher ones? There's fortunately a generating series that was also mentioned by Christian in his talk. This is the so-called Kronecker-Eisenstein series, a ratio of this theta function which you have seen before. And in the same way as we needed to add a non-holomorphic piece beforehand, we must do something similar for the entire generating series. To make that thing doubly periodic, we add this exponential factor using imz over im tau. Hence, it's no longer holomorphic, but it is double periodic. So every coefficient now in the Taylor expansion is a doubly periodic function and suitable to be integrated over torus cycles. Now, about this alpha quantity, we are here doing something perverse. This alpha, being an argument of a theta function, looks like a position on the torus. But here, we degrade that guy to just a bookkeeping device, to a bookkeeping device to distinguish different fn's as different coefficients in the Taylor expansion with respect to alpha. Okay, it's a Laurent expansion starting at a simple pole. Okay, now if you want to have the explicit form of some f, just go ahead and Taylor expand as far as you need, and then you arrive at an F2, something like that. Don't worry about the precise form. The really important thing about these things is how you manipulate them. For instance, the really important thing is that there's a Fay relation, which generalizes the partial fraction exercise, to any weight, to any Hausse number of these Fn's. So here, this is the quadratic Fay relation among the generating series, and that encodes all the relations that I need to investigate the differential structure of the iterated integrals and to do an analogy of partial fraction whenever I want to. Okay, so this generating series defines all the functions fn, and that's recorded here on the blackboard for later reference. This finishes what I wanted to say about the introductory part. Let me now come to the physics. Let me now give you some samples how these elliptic multiple zeta values show up in a stringy one-loop amplitude. For simplicity, we restrict to the four-point case and only discuss the planar cylinder, though there's also a non-planar one in a Möbius strip. Okay, what is the four-point open string one-loop amplitude? It has been worked out in 82 already by Green, Schwarz, and Brink. So they firstly figured out that you can peel off the polarizations. No need to worry about the state dependence anymore. The real challenge of understanding that amplitude boils down to a certain integral, a certain worldsheet integral. So everything here in this innocent-looking thing, it encodes the conformally inequivalent worldsheets that might describe the scattering process. As I warned you earlier on, the worldsheet of interest here is this cylinder where open string insertions are happening on the boundary. So you have to integrate out the possible insertion points while maintaining the ordering, the cyclically inequivalent one. And in contrast to tree level, there's also a modulus here which describes the length of the cylinder, which you can't scale away in CFT. And this translates into the torus parameter tau. So this is, if you wish, an integral over tau that is purely imaginary and describes the length of the cylinder. But for simplicity, let's just talk about tori to connect with all the discussions from before. It's just a projection of a torus. The parametrization is, as I mentioned before, setting the boundary to the real axis. So all the integrations are happening in the unit interval where we identify the antipodal points. Maybe I should have stressed this a bit more earlier on. This definition of EMZVs asks you simply to integrate over a cycle, just cut open through this choice of parametrization. Okay, and what is the really interesting magical part of the integrand? it's here this exponential of Green's functions on the torus. That's the famous Kolber-Nielsen factor, which also showed up in Dave's talk. And I don't need to specify what the propagator is. All you need to know about this Wheelchip propagator, its derivative, is the function f1, which we've discussed before, the D-log theta. So this is where we make contact between the framework of EMZVs and the superstring amplitude. Every term in this exponential can be expressed in terms of f1. That is why the description in terms of EMZVs will work. So what we'll do with this exponential is we Taylor expand them. So for each pair of points, here we have one such exponential series. And here I should make a really big disclaimer. In doing the Taylor expansion, I'm focusing on the analytic dependence of alpha prime. Of course, as you know well, there's also a log dependence on Mandelstam's and alpha prime, a log dependence which describes the Feynman integrals. And there's a well-defined procedure to disentangle the logs from the analytic part, like described by Michael Green and collaborators in the closed string case. So that's why you won't see the Feynman integrals directly, but we focus on the low energy effective action in the analytic alpha prime dependence. Okay, so in this Taylor expansion, whenever you see that propagator, just replace it by its integral representation. The propagator is an integral over F1, and that is why we'll land on EMZV sooner or later. Okay, at low orders, it's rather sooner than later. If you just keep the constant part of this Taylor expansion, if you take the zeroth order in the dot product of momenta, then I just have to remember that F0 is defined to be 1, and I identify omega 0, 0, 0. Okay, this is admittedly a very clumsy way of writing 1 over 6, so let me give you an example where there's a non-trivial dependence on tau. At the first order in alpha prime, when I have one propagator P12 or P13, I simply insert my integral definition, and then I identify this with a special case of the EMZV definition on the blackboard. And accordingly, you get some omega 1000, or sometimes I have to be careful about the integration domain to really squeeze it into that definition. But when the dust settles, you're left with a Q-linear combination of EMZVs. At each order in alpha prime, this is just one further example. Please don't go through all the details of the formula. This slide is mostly meant to tell you the Fay identity is your friend. The Fay identity that I mentioned before will be needed at some higher orders when you're asked to integrate something where, say, the integration variable appears also among the labels of an elliptic iterated integral. So this is just to show you that sometimes you have to use a Fay to combine the F1s to an F2. So also in these string amplitudes, not only F1 is needed, but the full-fledged tower of higher relatives. Okay, so here is a sample where later on you can remove the F2 appearance, but nevertheless, a generic result or a generic order in alpha prime will involve EMZVs with all sorts of letters. So here we are gathering the results up to order alpha prime cube beyond the leading order. So up to quadratic order in Mandelstam's, it's still a single EMZV. But starting from the third order, it looks like the linear combinations grow of these elliptic multiple zeta values. So we should massage them a little bit and simplify before we proceed to even higher orders. In principle, it's straightforward to work out these expressions, but we should cast them into a more illuminating form. So this was the moment where we realized it's time to invent a bit more maths. It's time to study systematically the Q relations among the EMZVs to cast these things into a more handy expression. And before doing this in more detail, let me just assure you that there's no loss of generality to discussing the four-point amplitude. Exactly the same discussion goes through for 5 points and higher. You can ask me again at the end of the talk if you want to see more details. All right, let's turn back to math and discuss Q relations among elliptic multiple zeta values. Just in case you got lost on some parts of the string discussion, this is a good point to re-enter. And let me again start with an analogy to genus zero, to the multiple zeta values. One of the most burning questions about MZVs is, how can we simplify them over the rational numbers? Or which ones can we no longer simplify? First of all, there are the odd single zeta values. And also, at higher weights, there are instances of higher depth, which you cannot help having in your basis. So you can't avoid having a depth 2 MZV at weight 8. And the way how you arrive at these simplifications is you throw together all the shuffle and stuffle relations that you can write down. So what's the elliptic analog of all the shuffle and stuffle relations? Well, first of all, the shuffle relation goes through immediately. It requires nothing else than the concept of an iterated integral. So certainly the in that we here satisfies a shuffle relation, which is written down here. Moreover, there's reflection that you can invert the labels on the expense of a plus minus sign. And now the novelty in contrast to genus zero, or let's say the less straightforward generalization, is the Fay. The Fay, which was also helpful in the simplification of the string alpha prime expansion. Just to recall, Fay is the elliptic upgrade of partial fraction. And here, in the concrete case of an EMZV, Fay allows you to transport weight back and forth between neighboring arguments. Here's a very simple instance, but generically they are a bit longer. Okay, now the question I would like to ask and address in the rest of the talk is, what happens if you throw together all of these relations? How many indecomposables do remain if you solve this equation system? And note that I can ask this question separately, weight by weight. Please recall, the weight is the sum of the n i's here, of the superscripts, not just the number of integrations. And still, the number of integrations, which was defined to be the length, is needed to bound the admissible objects to consider. In contrast to genus zero, we have a letter of zero weight, f0 equal 1. So if I insert more and more f0s to the iterated integral, I get an infinity of EMZVs at every fixed weight. So to avoid a discussion of infinitely many EMZVs at the same time, we should bound our zoo of objects not only by the weight, but also by the length. Let us discuss the relations among EMZVs, weight by weight and length by length. Okay, at length 1, everything is pretty simple. One can straightforwardly perform the integral, and what one finds, they are all constant, if not even vanishing. Only the even EMZVs at length 1 give something constant, namely an even zeta value. It's just about powers of pi, or they vanish. And something quite similar happens at length 2. Say, if I restrict the weight to be even at length 2, we find once more that they are just constants. But hang on, I promised you some functions of tau of the modular parameter. So up to here, we're just having pretty trivial cases, and the first non-trivial dependence on tau occurs at length 2 if you choose the weight to be odd, the weight n1 plus n2. So these are the first tau-dependent pieces. I'll show the expansion later on. But let me just comment on the relations that remain, on the indecomposable ones that remain after putting phase, shuffle, and reflection together. You can reduce any odd weight, double EMZV, to having zero entry in the first slot and an arbitrary odd entry in the second slot. So any other one can be reduced to those using a formula that, well, involves some even zeta values. But again, it's just a matter of pi. And in the bookkeeping of EMZVs, we consider the multiple zeta values as something known. So we just keep them as coefficient and don't count them as a new EMZV. Okay, this exercise can now be repeated at higher and higher lengths. But before going into details, let me extract the lesson about the even-odd distinction we just had. If minus 1 to the length is the same of minus 1 to the weight, then the EMZV is boring. You've just seen that if the weight is even and the length is even, then you just get the same stuff as at lower length. And a similar statement applies to any higher length and weight. You should make sure that their parity is different, that minus 1 to the length is different from minus 1 to the weight. Accordingly, at length 3, it's only worthwhile to discuss even weight EMZVs. And let's now check weight by weight what remains after using shuffle, Fay, and reflection. So here is a bit of data. A typical relation to arrive at such a basis of indecomposables is shown here, just as an example. And if you want to have more of those, let me invite you to visit our website, which, let's say, belongs to today's paper. Here you can download more and more of these relations for a variety of lengths and weights. Okay, for completeness, the same story at length 4. Here you should better demand an odd weight to be an interesting case. Here is a sample of indecomposable ones, and all the others of that length and weight are reducible to the ones in the table. And let me highlight the close formulas which we could give up to those lengths. Say at length 3, we can give an all-weight formula for the number of indecomposable ones. It's the ceiling function of the weight over 6, which you can verify here to be true for those examples. And at conjectural level, we believe to have a similar close formula at length 4. Let's say there's a lot of evidence to high weights that this is the right number of indecomposables at weight W. Just check today's paper for more details. And here's an overview of higher length and higher weight data. So this is, if you wish, the elliptic analog of the Brodhorst-Kreimer conjecture for EMZVs at different depths and weights. So far, we don't have more than just data and methods to obtain it, and it's still desirable to obtain a close formula for all possible lengths and weights. That's something we hope to work on in the near future. But up to now, you might complain that this is rather uninspired procedure to brute force, write down all the possible phase shuffles reflections. Is there a more inspired way? Is there something combinatorial to predict these numbers without asking Maple or Mathematica to solve the equation system? Unfortunately, the answer is yes. There are some very nice combinatorial principles described in today's paper and to be described right now. I'll do a little detour before coming to the combinatorial principle. The detour being, we can just compute them. How can we compute the dependence on the modular parameter in these EMZVs? In contrast to MZVs, there's an additional structure set by tau, the modular parameter. And it's something you can differentiate in. If you take the tau derivative, or here traded for the Q parameter from Christian's talk, if you do this Q derivative of an EMZV, you obtain some more EMZVs decorated by Eisenstein series. So Eisenstein series are, say, something like the working horse in the study of modular forms. They have a known Q expansion and transforms nicely if you change the description of the torus. But for the moment, just think of them as objects with a known Q expansion. Okay, and those show up in the Q derivative of an EMZV. And in taking this derivative, it turns out that you reduce the length. So one of the highlights of this formula is that the right-hand side has a lower length as compared to the left-hand side. So you can recursively go down in length by iterating these derivatives, and you just catch more and more Eisenstein series, which are under control by this formula here. Okay, in this sense, the differential equation in tau is nice, and before we can solve it, we have to supplement a boundary value. So how do these things behave if I go to Q equals 0, or equivalently tau to I infinity? This was studied by Enriquez in the same way as Enriquez studied the differential equation. The boundary value is dictated by MZVs. Whenever you set Q equal to 0 in an EMZV, you just obtain some MZVs decorated by 2 pi I. Okay, this might look a bit pedantic, but since I pi is not an MZV, I should mention it here. You get, if you study the generating series of EMZVs, nothing but the Drinfeld associator, if you go to the boundary Q equals 0. So here, this degeneration to the Drinfeld associator allows you to really obtain a unique solution to that differential equation of first order here. So there's no obstacle in computing the Q expansion for any EMZV, no matter which length or which weight. But to fulfill the promise about a combinatorial principle, let me take advantage of this differential equation to propose an alternative enumeration scheme. Instead of the Eisenstein series, we take the interesting part with the Q expansion, throwing away the constant term. So all the Q dependence of an EMZV stems from an iterated integral over Eisenstein series, over d log Q, over and over again. So this is a very harsh paradigm shift. We started out with an iterated integral over torus punctures here, integral over z. But now the differential equation asks us to trade this for an iterated integral over different Qs, over different modular parameters of elliptic curves. So we are motivated to study a whole variety of different tori to capture the structure of EMZVs and the Q dependence. By the way, these iterated Eisenstein integrals here are a special case of more general objects, iterated Shimura integrals, studied by Manin and Brown, among other people, where more general integrands appear here. But this is just to mention the mathematical context. The EMZVs pick out a subsector of iterated Shimura integers. Okay, and these gammas are a good model to capture the Q dependence of EMZVs. At worst, you have some MZV coefficient in front of one of these guys. And let me emphasize once more, in this discussion, we treat the MZVs as something known, like boundary data. All right. To give an explicit appearance of the Q expansion, since we know the Q expansion of the Eisenmann series, nothing stops you to perform all the iterated integrals. It's something very cheap which you use. I'd almost feel embarrassed to show this formula. All this to say that you can work out the Q expansion of an arbitrary iterated Eisenstein integral, and what you get is amusingly a nested sum which strongly resembles MZVs. You might have asked yourself earlier on, since I made contact with the integral representation of MZVs, is there also an analog of the sum representation, of the nested sum representation of MZVs, shown here? And here is the answer. The iterated Eisenstein integrals take you as close as you can get to the nested sum representation of MZVs. The only elliptic decoration can be found in the numerator. So here, this sigma is a divisor function. Don't worry about the details. All you need to know about that numerator here is that it depends on Q and that it's sufficiently complicated to obstruct a Stoffel relation. Since, as you know well, MZVs can be related using Stoffel by some rearrangements, but you can't do that in presence of this numerator here. So these iterated Eisenstein integrals are a pretty rigid structure. They have no further relations beyond Stoffel. So Stoffel is once more clear by the iterated integral definition, but there is nothing beyond that simply because the divisor sums prevent you from doing further reductions. Okay, and here's just for your entertainment an example at length 2, how the indecomposable ones at length 2 can be translated into an explicit Q expansion. Of course, you can do the same at higher length. Good. Having discussed these Stoffel independent Eisenstein integrals, we could ask, are they by themselves sufficient to do an enumeration of EMZVs? So the naive picture one could get up to here is, just take all the Stoffel-independent iterated Eisenstein integrals and try to identify those with the indecomposable EMZVs. So here this line just means mod out by Stoffel relations. It's meant to be a quotient. So at length 2, we could succeed in this naive picture in the sense that a single Eisenstein integral corresponds to a length 2 EMZV. But this dictionary fails at higher length. It seems like we have too many iterated Eisenstein integrals to describe the indecomposables at length 3. So we are lacking some ingredient. There appears to be a selection rule in the sense that not every iterated Eisenstein integral is allowed to appear in the world of EMZVs. And indeed, this selection rule is governed by a so-called derivation algebra. I'll define these guys on the next slide. So all you need to know is there is a derivation algebra with some known commutator relations, and every such commutation relations is a selection rule. It lowers the number of available EMZVs. So these commutation relations here are responsible for the mismatch, which you see here. The clean way of saying all of this is these derivations epsilon, they appear in the elliptic version of the Drinfeld associator. So there is something like an elliptic associator, a generating series of EMZVs. And if you compute the tau derivative on the entire associator, then you are naturally driven to that derivation algebra. Without worrying about the details, let me emphasize that the derivations, epsilon, they naturally pop out in the differential equation for the associator. And what they do is, the derivations, they reshuffle the non-commutative letters. In the same way as the Drinfeld associator has non-commutative variables E0 and E1, we have such a non-commutative alphabet in the elliptic associator, and there's an explicit representation of the derivations which whirls around in the associator. So all this to say is that there is a good reason why the derivation algebra appears as setting up selection rules on the admissible Eisenstein integrals. Okay, so the precise picture, the combinatorial principle is, if you want to know how many indecomposables EMZVs exist at given weight, at given length, Then you should firstly count the shuffle-independent iterated Eisenstein integrals, defined here for reference, and then mod out by the relations in the derivation algebra. This is something which has been nicely studied in mathematics, Aaron Pollack being one of the main actors. And then, for instance, we can see that there's only a very rigid linear combination of certain iterated Eisenstein integrals. So here, this example here, they only appear in this combination, gamma 10-4 and gamma 8-6, and never in isolation. And this is reflected in a commutator relation in the derivation algebra. And there's no problem to extend this counting to higher lengths and weights, and this led to the data up to weight length 7, which you have seen before. For more details, I would like to refer you to today's paper. Now it's really time that I wrap up. Let me summarize, first of all, the cast of characters. What kind of objects have appeared in this talk? There were generalizations of multiple polylogarithms to elliptic iterated integrals, where you integrate a bunch of these fn's iteratedly over the elliptic curve. The differential forms at tree level, there are just two of them, d log z and d log 1 minus z, whereas in the elliptic world we need an infinity of letters f0, f1, f2, all the way up. And in the same way as partial fraction governs the dynamics of the d log z's, there is a Fay relation to shuffle around bilinears in fn's. If you specialize these polylogarithms or elliptic iterated integrals, then you land on EMZVs or the MZVs, and the weight is here defined to be the sum of the arguments, whereas here it's just the number of arguments. And the application in physics, among other things, MZVs appear in the alpha prime expansion of superstring trees, and I showed you some examples how EMZVs appear in the alpha prime expansion of one loop amplitudes of the open superstring. And to summarize the later part of the talk, if you want to enumerate the indecomposable EMZVs, or if you want to classify their Q relations, then you have to weld together all the shuffle reflection and Fay identities. But apart from this brute force approach, there's a more inspired way to do the bookkeeping. Namely, you should translate the EMZVs into iterated Eisenstein integrals defined over there. And they have fewer relations, namely nothing beyond shuffle. And on top of that, there are selection rules governed by the derivation algebra, which I'm afraid was treated in a rather sketchy way. So for more details, please consult today's paper. And once more, you're cordially invited to play with the relations gathered at the website here. That's all I wanted to say about elliptic stuff. On top of that, I would like to encourage all of you to register for an anniversary conference in honor of Albert Einstein, which is going to take place in Berlin in early December. As you can see, there's also Svi talking, so certainly there will be amplitudes present as well. Yeah, please go ahead and register. Thank you very much for your attention.
So I had a question, which is maybe not directly related to your talk or the subject, but when you said the amplitude was an integral over tau or IT, and you just integrate from, well, I guess for all rectangular tori, I was wondering why do you only integrate over rectangular tori?
So in the same way as the closed string amplitude has a complex modulus to describe the world sheets, you only need a real modulus here to describe the parametrize the different conformally inequivalent cylinders here.
If you try to look for open-closed string duality, do you get something more? Or,
I mean, you mean how it relates to the objects in the closed string counterpart? Yeah, let's say the closed string counterpart has been studied by...
You mean you can go to the channel in which you have open-closed string. Instead
Having
the cylinder, you have the loop of the open string.
Right.
Now, so, if you take into account, there is a symmetry. So you can express as a tree diagram of closed string or as the loop of open string. So there is a relation. Now, this relation should be valid for each order of alpha prime.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Will you get something more if you...
So we just started to study the non-planar analog to that story. So if you populate both cylinder boundaries with vertex operator insertions, you first of all land on new classes of periods. My expectation is that this will be the analog of an Euler sum with alternating signs, something like that. And on top of that, as you emphasize, there's a closed string propagating in this non-planar channel. So we have one more obstruction to do a Taylor expansion, namely to take this massless pole into account due to the exchange of closed string. So we are really looking forward to studying this and to study the interplay of this pole term with the regular term, which is described by these Euler sums of elliptic type. But it's mostly work in progress.
Thank you for this very clear and interesting talk. I have a strong question about the elliptic MZVs because I'm not an expert. But I just saw, like, 1 week ago there was a preprint by Leila Schnepps where she defined an elliptic double shuffle algebra. Have you looked at this? Is there any, because you're talking about relations about elliptic MZV, and that's why I'm just curious. I haven't read it. I don't know the details, but.
So here it would be great if our collaborator Niels was present. He just spent a week in Paris visiting Leila Schnepps and discussing this at length. And as far as I understood from Niels, in discussions with Leila, he found a convergence of counting. Namely, this number of indecomposables at length 3, it appears that Leila had seen this number in a similar context, or this is what I understood from Niels. And I'm looking forward to the next meeting with Niels to learn more about the outcome of his discussions with Leila.
Okay.
I don't see any more questions, so let's thank Oliver again.